These were a set of parallel walls that ran from the city walls. And the city walls run about 4 miles around the city. And these parallel walls ran to the Piraeus, the port, and the various naval installations there, such as Munichia and Zea, Etionia, the fortress, and in effect connected Athens to her port. That's a circuit of 16 miles enclosing a vast area. And already Pericles was thinking that in the event of a future war, the Athenian population could be evacuated into Athens, and in that district between the long walls, the population could be supplied by sea, and the ravaging of Attica would be an immaterial issue. This is clearly the strategy adopted in 432 BC, and if you think of it for a moment, it's really a variation of what the Athenians did in 480 BC when they evacuated Attica and fought the naval battle at Salamis. It's an extension on that strategy. Therefore, under the 30 Years' Peace, the handing over of Megara and Boeotia back to the Peloponnesians was not really a strategic issue to the Athenians, at least in Pericles' mind. And we'll get to that again in 432 BC, because in some ways those long walls gave Pericles perhaps a false sense of security when he was dealing with the final crisis. In addition, the Spartans made some very important concessions, not only to the matter of the territorial integrity of the Athenian Empire, but the Spartans did not push the issue of Aegina. That island polis remained under Athenian control, and there is no evidence that the Athenians did anything with Aegina that was any way different with what they did with their other allies. This becomes an issue in 432, where the Aeginetans go before the Spartan assembly complaining of their treatment by the Athenians, but this was all legal under the 30 Years' Peace. Aegina was a member of the Delian League, for which you can read Athenian Empire, and Athens had the right to do what it wished with it. And that was enshrined in the treaty, and that was a violation of freedom and autonomy, at least as the Peloponnesians understood it. But the treaty was signed, and the Athenians had the legal right to behave as they would wish to do with their allies. So that when you look at all the terms lined up together, it's really a rather successful treaty in its conception. It allowed Athens, Pericles, under Pericles' leadership, to consolidate control of the Aegean, to push political reform in Athens. The great building programs are initiated in the period after the treaty. Athens had the prosperity and the peace to achieve that classical moment that everyone thinks of as the epitome of the whole classical age, the age of Pericles, the golden age, as it's often taught in textbooks. That was, in a large extent, a result of the success of the 30 Years' Peace, which remained in effect for 17 years, and gave Pericles the opportunity to show his real genius, which was in the assembly as an orator, as a far-thinking man in terms of political reform, in initiating numerous building projects that not only put drachmae, that is coins, in the purses of Athenian citizens, but also turned Athens into what he would like to call the School of Greece, whereby he means the model of Greece. It also created an Athens that would be the financial and economic capital of the Aegean world, we'll discuss that, as well as the intellectual capital, which would attract all sorts of thinkers, the so-called sophists, the members of an important intellectual movement, the philosopher Socrates. It saw the writing of some of the finest of the tragedies of Sophocles, Euripides, the comedies of Aristophanes. All of this possible because of the consolidation of the Athenian Empire and the prosperity and peace that came out of the fighting of the 450s and the early 440s. So Athens would prosper a great deal under this treaty, and it really would make Pericles' reputation as a great leader. Well, let me look at two points about this treaty, and a point that I will return to when we get, an issue that I will return to when we get to the final crisis. That is, the two sides signed a legal document, and they swore oaths, and they intended to abide by them. But there's always a difference to what people agree to in writing and what people think they understand in writing. And I think this is particularly true when you're dealing with the Greek world, where writing, maybe not so much for the Athenians now, but writing for most Greeks is really an exceptional act. And they think much more in terms of tradition and what is appropriate. Eudoxos is the word that would always come up in Greek. What is seemly, what is well-seeming, what is right and proper to be, rather than necessarily the letter of the law. I'm not sure what the Spartans really understood by this treaty.